Curious and want to try a DNA test, but concerned about your genetic data being shared? Secret Sequence is an anonymous genetic testing company. You never give your name for any reason, so they don't sell or share your data, unlike many other companies. They offer various tests, including ancestry, nutrition, exercise. I've done a few myself, and it's really interesting to learn about yourself. For $25 off two kits or more, head over to secretsequence.com and use promo code DNA Today. Again, that's DNA Today at secretsequence.com for $25 off two kits or more.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA.
We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health, usually through interviews with genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and more. My guest on this episode is Dr. Becky Winslow, who is a doctor of clinical pharmacy. She's a clinical pharmacogenetics implementation consortium member, a registered pharmacogenomics education provider, and the owner of Ingenious Rx LLC. Thanks so much, Dr. Becky Winslow, for coming on the program. I'm really excited to talk to you and hear your insight about pharmacogenomics.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'll start by saying that there's two words that are commonly used interchangeably. One is pharmacogenomics, the other is pharmacogenetics. So I'll explain the difference between those. Pharmacogenomics studies how all of the genes in the genome can influence responses to drugs. And pharmacogenetics usually refers to how variation in one single gene influences the response to a single drug. And in general, pharmacogenomics combines pharmacology, which is the science of drugs, and genomics, which is the study of genes and their function, to develop effective, safe medications and doses that will be tailored to a person's genetic makeup.
And that was something I was always a little bit confused on before
yes.
we started talking about this, because I was like, oh, pharmacogenomics, that's just the general term. But it really is different between pharmacogenomics being more of an overarching look and pharmacogenetics focused on specific gene, a gene change. So there is that difference, that's a little nuanced difference between the two.
Yes, absolutely.
And what is the current status of the field? It seems to be kind of a buzzword right now in genetics. Is this something that is we're really far along, or are we figuring things out?
Sure. Pharmacogenomics is really still in its infancy. With that being said, the field is growing rapidly. There are currently only around 300 medications that have either actionable PGX data, informative PGX data, or PGX testing required in their FDA labeling. Compared to all the medications that are available, that's a small number. Now, pharmacogenomics testing is supported by level one evidence for some medications that are used in cancer, cardiovascular disease, hematology, infectious disease, neurology, pain, psychiatry and addiction, rheumatology, urology, and a few other less common diseases. And just to explain, level one evidence means that there's an established evidence-based clinical guideline from international pharmacogenomics societies or regulatory bodies. And of the 300 medications that I mentioned have pharmacogenomic labeling, only 47 of those actually have CPIC guidelines for their implementation into the clinical setting.
So this is really recent and new that we're establishing these guidelines, but really just how certain genes and genetic changes are related to being able to metabolize drugs either really well or very poorly to start differentiating between people where drug A works for them or drug B works better for them. So we're starting to map this out. It sounds like almost a rough draft.
Correct. Of course, pharmacogenomics has been studied heavily in academia. The actual use of pharmacogenomics testing is a newer phase of pharmacogenomics. But I mean, that's what most new healthcare entities go through. They start with research and in academia, and then they move into use. With that being said, the expenditures for precision medicine are increasing. And so research and development will contribute to the evidence base that's actually needed to justify pharmacogenomics as a standard of care. So I believe we'll get there.
Yeah, it's exciting just seeing from the Precision Medicine Initiative, I think 2015, is that right, when that started? And 5 years later, we have made a lot of progress, but we have a lot of progress to go.
Correct. Correct. We have come a long way from 2015, and we have a long way to go, but it's healthcare and we want to do it right. So I was going to say it's important that we have an evidence base for this.
Definitely. And with more research, we're starting to gather more of that information when we're making more informed decisions based on medications and saying we're a little bit more sure that, you know, certain medication is going to fit well with someone based on more and more evidence that we have as our databases grow. I'm curious, what are the various types of tests available? It doesn't sound like there's one pharmacogenomic test.
Right. Single gene panels are available and multi-gene panels are available. So, whereas we talked about pharmacogenetics being about a single gene and pharmacogenomics being multi-genes, it's all dependent on what the physician or the prescriber is looking for, what type of data they're looking for, as to whether they choose one versus the other.
And when they're ordering these tests, how accurate do they expect the results to be, and how informative in terms of deciding which medication to prescribe? Is this a major factor? Is this maybe a main factor in deciding, or is it really a small factor? They're looking at other aspects of a person, maybe family members where certain drugs have worked well for them, say someone's brother, X drug worked for them, let's try that for you too. How influential is this information in making that decision?
Mm-hmm. Pharmacogenomics testing is really a tool in the precision medicine toolbox. It's should not be used as the sole determining factor. It should be the results from pharmacogenomics tests should be considered with all the other patients' factors in determining which medication works best for that patient, and et cetera.
And what areas of healthcare are we really utilizing this testing? Before, you mentioned cancer being one in terms of, I would imagine, and my experience has been cancer treatments of saying, let's see which drug works best for your genetic profile and the type of cancer you have. What other areas are we really starting to utilize this information? Because it seems like we're on the cusp of this new venture.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. Oncology has been using pharmacogenomics more as a standard, like you said, to determine the best cancer treatments. Now we're moving out into non-oncology pharmacogenomic testing as the body of evidence to support non-oncology pharmacogenomic testing has increased. For example, pharmacogenomic testing is used to determine if a patient will experience a non-therapeutic drug response to clopidogrel. And this is termed clopidogrel resistance. Clopidogrel is prescribed for patients who've experienced a negative blood clotting event, such as a stroke, heart attack, or deep vein thrombosis. So clopidogrel prevents platelets from sticking together to form blood clots, and it reduces the patient's chances for another thrombotic event. So you can see the importance in a prescriber knowing whether a patient metabolizes this drug appropriately so that they will have a therapeutic outcome.
And a therapeutic outcome, that means that the drug is preventing what it should be preventing. Am I getting that right?
Correct. A therapeutic outcome is the patient is achieving the end result that we want them to achieve by using that medication, preferably without use limiting adverse drug events.
So negative side effects that go along with that in order to get to that goal and stay stable.
Mm-hmm.
Much of medicine is currently tied to standards of practice, more of a one-size-fits-all approach where protocols are followed. How quickly do you foresee pharmacogenomics impacting this type of medical practice and shifting it to be more of that personalized medicine, precision medicine that we mentioned before?
Sure. Pharmacogenomics is already impacting the one-size-fits-all approach as prescribers in academia and academic institutions are utilizing pharmacogenomics, and also with prescribers in the community who are comfortable with practicing, I guess you could say, outside the box. They also have been utilizing pharmacogenomics testing to individualize patients' treatments. This is particularly common in the mental health area, with psychiatrists using pharmacogenomic testing to help guide medications used for mental health purposes. Now, you asked, how quickly do I think it would be a standard of practice? Well, with medicine, of course, it takes quite an evidence base. It takes quite some time, typically, to develop a standard. So I can see it happening. We've come a long ways since 2015 with the Precision Medicine Initiative. We will get there, I would probably say, within the next decade, hopefully long before that.
And it has to become more mainstream before even becoming like a standard of practice. I feel like that's like the ultimate, you know, goal of getting there. But for doctors to just start using it because they see how useful it can be and really expediting the process of finding the right medication. I think you're mentioning with mental health conditions, to me, that's where my brain goes first with this, because with other types of medication, it's a little bit more standard of, oh, okay, it's one, two, or three of these medications, you know, let's try this. But for mental health, there's so many different types of medications and then so many different dosage. And looking at that, it can take people so long to find which medication works for them of limited side effects, but having that goal of being able to stabilize them. And so to be able to speed up that process would just be huge for the field. And I'm excited to see that really be coming to fruition and happening. And we're getting closer to it. And I think this is, you know, we talked about cancer a little bit, cardiac. I see this really changing mental health. I don't know if I'm just wishful thinking or if this can be a thing in the near future.
No, I mean, you're accurate. You know, while the American Psychological Association has not given pharmacogenomics its, you know, two thumbs up, they are beginning to accept it more. And that, like I said, is based on the evidence that's being generated. There have been quite a few clinical studies done which are showing the shortened time to recovery and the decrease in adverse drug reactions and how that translates to cost savings, not only for the patient, but also for the healthcare system and also, for example, employers whose employees may be missing work or they may not be performing well on the job because their mental health is not where it needs to be. So, absolutely. A lot of progress in the mental health area with pharmacogenomics.
And talking about cost, how costly is this testing looking at? I mean, it has so many impacts in so many areas of life that you kind of just mentioned quickly of like, if you're not in a healthy enough place to be going to work, you're missing work. So there's a financial aspect there. Insurance companies paying for multiple doctor's appointments just to figure out the right medication. So how much is, I don't know, we've talked about there's so many different types of testing, but what's that ballpark that we're looking at of the cost of testing?
Sure. The cost for the test has decreased significantly over the last few years. from around, it has decreased from around $1,500 per test to around $500 now. And that's for a multi-gene panel. So with that $500, you're getting not only mental health medications being looked at, but also your cardiovascular pain, et cetera. So when you compare that, the cost of that test to, say, a hospital admission, $500 sounds very inexpensive.
It's like nothing.
Exactly.
Like, I can't imagine what an ER visit is, but I'm picturing it's much more than that.
Oh, absolutely. An ER visit, or with an admission to the hospital, runs around $30,000. So,
well, that's a big difference.
that's a big return on your investment if you're able to prevent an admission to the hospital.
So with that in mind, do you think that insurance companies are going to start covering this, as seeing this as prevention almost?
Mm-hmm. Sure. The insurance industry has some mixed feelings about this test. And the reason why they do, I mean, they have a good justification. The average person on an insurance plan only remains on that plan for around 18 months total. So insurers have needed and wanted an economic justification that the pharmacogenomics test that they're paying for will give them their return on investment within that 18 months. And because academia realized that they wanted this information, studies and research have been done. And so, yes, they are starting to pay for pharmacogenomic testing. As a matter of fact, a national healthcare organization, insurer, just last week approved coverage for pharmacogenomic testing for patients who have have failed at least one medication for either depression or anxiety. So
that's a pretty low threshold to only have tried one medication that doesn't work, because mm-hmm. people often go on many medications to get to one that somewhat works for them. Mm-hmm. So that's surprising to hear. I would think it'd be higher.
Well, I guess we all know that healthcare is a business, so I'm sure. I'm sure that they did the calculations to determine, you know, what is it costing them for the patient not to get the test, like we discussed earlier, with added doctor's visits, missed days of work, and et cetera. So,
and for this testing, we've been talking about testing within one area of, say, cancer, mental health, cardiac. But do you imagine this expanding a little bit more to be more generalized, where people are getting a test that's going to give them information for a variety of drugs, where they're going to start using this information in many different doctor's office, where they'll say, hey, you're mm-hmm. going to prescribe me a medication. Here's my results. Let's see what I should be doing. Do you think it's going to become a little bit more generalized?
What I foresee is that as the cost of testing continues to fall, that it's going to be similar to going to your physician's office and getting an A1C for your blood sugar. You know, the test is going to be so low that we won't think about not having the test done. And then there's another way that pharmacogenomics testing is headed, and that's in the form of companion diagnostics. So I'm sure that you're familiar with some of the latest medications that have come out that cost $30,000 a month, or
all those new medications that took so many decades of research to get a drug, right?
Mm-hmm. What you're going to see is that those medications are going to be accompanied by a companion diagnostic test. In other words, the patient has to qualify with their genetic profile to get that medication, because otherwise it doesn't make sense for them to take the medication. And that's a lot of money wasted if the medication doesn't work for the patient.
That's a good point. If a medication's costing $30,000 a month, say, and mm-hmm. it might sound astronomical to people, but that is realistic for some, unfortunately, mm-hmm. take a $500 to $1,000 genetic test just to make sure that's going to work for you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So pharmacogenomics will do two things. For standard drugs or standard therapy that we've had for years, I will see it being so cost effective that we won't think about doing it. And then secondly, to prevent people from taking medications that don't work for them that are so high cost. So
I think the next aspect of this would be we're doing this genetic testing, getting results, ordering drugs based on those results, but there needs to be a bridge between these results and patients and doctors understanding these results. How much are today's physicians and pharmacists really able to interpret these results for themselves, take that another level down to the patient to be able to explain this? Is this something that we're doing and we're good at and people are being trained in school? Or is there a big discrepancy where providers are not able to really be utilizing this information? Because the tools are there, but do they know how to use them?
Sure, sure. In general, in my personal experience over the last 6 years in working with physicians and working with pharmacists to help educate about pharmacogenomics and to help them appropriately implement pharmacogenomics, I would say that it would be very helpful for both physicians and pharmacists to receive more pharmacogenomics education in their university programs, and especially not even so much the science of pharmacogenomics, but how to actually implement pharmacogenomics into workflows and that type of clinical implementation. Now, as you mentioned, patients, do patients know how to handle this data? I will tell you that for the most part, currently, patients aren't particularly the ones demanding pharmacogenomics testing. Patients, for the most part now, either A, they don't know about pharmacogenomics testing, two, they don't maybe value the testing because their insurance doesn't cover it, or three, they cannot afford the testing, even if they realize its value. So most of the pharmacogenomics testing now is being driven by those prescribers and those pharmacists who are well educated on the appropriate utilization of PGX data. And they know how to handle the information and they know how to communicate that data to the patient. And it's also very helpful that clinical decision support tools are available that assist the prescriber at the point of prescribing in managing medication therapy that utilizes not only drug gene information, but drug gene drug and drug gene data. So there are tools to make this a smoother process.
And I'm sure we're adding to these tools and adjusting education in terms of pharmacists and physicians are in school, so that's part of it. Genetics has been incorporated more and more into that education, and I'm sure, you know, it's going to be in the future as well. Coming from a genetic counseling perspective, I see this as possibly an opportunity for genetic counselors to be more involved in the pharmacy side with that marriage of, you know, pharmacy and genomics, genetics, to be able to help with this testing and understand it and begin to utilize it more. It sounds like there are pharmacists that are on board either using this or staying up to date to where they feel they're comfortable to start using this when the research is enough. And then there's others that are probably saying, well, I don't know, I wasn't taught this in school. I'm not sure how to use this. Is it even accurate? So it seems like there's almost kind of two parties there.
Yes.
And we're going to start exploring that more in the future and figuring it out.
Well, I absolutely believe that there is a collaborative relationship amongst healthcare professionals to make any healthcare, any test or screening, you know, to make it more effective. And you're absolutely right. What genetic counselors know about genetics complements what pharmacists know about medications, what physicians know about diagnosing. So it's a partnership, and a team effort is going to make it even better.
I can definitely see this becoming a newer area in genetic counseling. We're kind of slowly becoming into every area of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I can see where someone maybe is a genetic counselor and a pharmacist or has a specialization mm-hmm. in this to be able to move this field forward. And for hospitals, seeing that as advantageous to have someone that is really well-versed in both.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
So where else do you see the field in the next few years? Anything that we haven't talked about before we wrap up of the future? I mean, we're talking about the Precision Medicine Initiative that's still continuing. And, you know, with these drugs, is there anything else that comes to mind when you're looking at, say, the next couple years, 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked about how research will improve or increase evidence bases. We've talked about how test prices will come down. I think what we may not have mentioned and needs mentioning is that I believe that patients are going to become more accepting and less fearful that sharing their genetic data, that it won't be used inappropriately. There are even companies that allow patients to profit from sharing their data. So I think that's an important factor to think about, too, is the general public's their comfort level with genetics and pharmacogenetics. I think that will increase.
And I think that's even just increasing within genetics, that people used to be very hesitant, and some still are, of genetics and genetic testing. But the more normalized it becomes, the more commercials we have on TV mm-hmm. about genetic testing, the more times it's covered in the news, people are more exposed to it, and the more exposed you are to something, a little bit less wary of it. Mm-hmm. And I could definitely see that happening more with pharmacogenomics, and for people being excited that they don't have to do trial and error all the time, that maybe they can yes. be a little bit more streamlined in that process. It's yes. exciting.
Some of my patients have said to me, why didn't I know about this before? Like, why would anybody ever take a medication without taking
it's a
test?
Great question.
Right. You know, so yes, the patients, once they understand it, can afford it, I believe they'll embrace it. Absolutely.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Winslow, for coming on the program and, you know, allowing me to pick your brain about pharmacogenomics and all the different bioethics kind of around it we touched on, and legislation and mm-hmm. the testing, insurance, different areas that we're covering with cancer, mental health, cardiac, and so many others that, you know, we didn't have time to talk about. It's very exciting where it's headed, and I'm looking forward to circling back on this and seeing the progress that we've made. So thank you so much for offering so much insight today.
Thank you for having me. I love educating and advocating for pharmacogenomics. So invite me back anytime.
Sounds great. Thanks for listening. For more information from this episode, you can go to dnapodcast.com. There is information from every episode I've done. So this is number 108. So there's 108 episodes on dnapodcast.com. The podcast players don't have all of the episodes. Once you get to 100, sometimes they don't show all of them. So if you want to listen to all the episodes, you can go to dnapodcast.com. If you're interested in following on social media, you can go to Twitter. I'm at dnapodcast, just like the website. Instagram, a little different, at DNA Radio, and really active on there as well, promoting clips from the episode along with different things that I'm doing in grad school and becoming a genetic counselor. If you have any questions, you can send them in at info@dnapodcast.com. That includes if you have a question for a guest, I'm happy to pass that along to the guest that was on the show, or if you have a question about genetic counseling, applying to genetic counseling schools. I know the application cycle is starting up again now that it's September, so you can check out actually episodes 87 and 97, where me and three other, at the time, incoming genetic counseling graduate students came on the show, and we shared our experience going from starting applications and all the preparation we did to start applications all the way to interviews, ranking, and matching within the new match system. I think this is now the third year they're going to be doing this. Yeah, third year. I was in the first. So if you're starting out applications or if you're going to be applying in the future, definitely check out episodes 87 and 97. And actually episode 101, I talk about the first year of grad school and how that goes. So you can check that out. I'm actually with three of my fellow classmates on that episode. And if you are listening to this on a podcast player, I would really, really appreciate if you could rate and review on your podcast apps like Apple and iTunes. Really appreciate that. That is how new listeners oftentimes find the show. So really appreciate if you could leave a rate and review on there. And also wanted to mention before I wrap up here that I was a guest on FAQ Fitness podcast. And so thank you, Parker and Chuck, for having me on the show. It was a great conversation. We talked about so many different topics in genetics. We talked about genetic testing, especially direct consumer, obviously genetic counseling, ethics, insurance, future of genetics. So we covered a lot of different topics and really a casual sit-down conversation. So it was awesome to be on that show. And if you're interested in hearing a little bit more, you can go check them out, FAQ Fitness Podcast. So thanks again, Parker and Chuck. But thanks to you for listening to this episode, and if you're a longtime listener, all the episodes you've listened to. I wanted to remind you about Secret Sequence's exclusive offer to you as a DNA Today listener. If your genetic privacy is important to you, but you still want to do a DNA kit, head over to secretsequence.com and use code DNA Today at checkout for $25 off two kits or more. I've done a bunch of the kits myself, ancestry, exercise, nutrition, and skincare. If you want to hear about my experience using those, listen back to episode 105 with the founders. I share some of my results on there, parts of which were new information for me, like being at a higher risk for joint injuries and fractures, something to keep in mind with my workouts. Also, that a Mediterranean diet isn't likely to be as effective as a low-fat carb diet for me to maintain a healthy weight. Other results confirmed what I've already experienced in life, such as liking the bitter taste of coffee. I actually drink it pretty much black, only a little sugar, while being really sensitive to its caffeine and having sensitive skin and bad acne, not the best genes I've inherited. Check it out for yourself using promo code DNA Today at secretsequence.com. Be sure to follow them on Facebook. They're at Secret Sequence Official. Join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics. The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.